Everyone, welcome to Innov and Crea. Today my guest is Victoria Finley. Welcome, Victoria.
Hi, really nice to be here.
I'm so excited that you accepted my invitation. Now, today, at the time of recording, it's mid-November in Quebec City. It's a rainy and gray day. And I can't imagine a better moment to talk about the history of colors.
And in this countryside near to Bath, where I'm talking to you from, we've still got some fall colors, which obviously we call autumn colors.
Oh.
And
yes,
it's been so blowy that the leaves have covered the lawn, although it has given us a moment of respite.
Very inspiring. Victoria, you're a journalist and author. You wrote several books and you've traveled the world to discover the history of colors in art, the history of textile, of jewels. They make such fabulous, beautiful books. The one that I want to talk about today for everybody to discover is The Brilliant History of Colors in Art.
So that was a book that I wrote in 2014. It was amazing, actually. It was The Brilliant History of Colors in Art was written. It was commissioned by the Getty Museum in Los Angeles. And
that's how it came to be.
And my first book had been called Color in Britain, Travels Through the Paint Box in the US and Canada. It was called Natural History of the Palette. But it was basically my excitement as somebody who at the time, and it was 22 years ago, I couldn't find a book that was easily accessible that told me about colors and where they came from. And so I had just written a book about looking for the origins of dyes and paints. And that included, for example, cochineal. And when I was a little girl, I learned that cochineal was made from these bugs and that it was in, well, actually, I don't think I knew about cherry coke at the time, but it was in lipstick and some kind of eyeshadows and things like that. It was like bug's blood. That's so weird. And I said to my mother, what kind of person would farm bugs for their red? And she said, I really have no idea. And so that was one of the many things that I thought when I was in my 30s and finally getting around to this subject that was a complete passion for me. I thought, right, I'm going to meet people who do this. I mean, it's a complicated industry. It's you know, you're killing a lot of creatures. And but I didn't know before I started that these little bugs, they look like bed bugs, which I have had experience of in various travels that
I've done.
But basically, if you haven't had experience and you're very lucky, they're kind of, I suppose, if you imagine the size of a 10-year-old child's little fingernail, that kind of size, a bit smaller than my fingernail. And they are white. They're really snowy white. They're so snowy white that when people, when a Frenchman in the 18th century went to try and break the secret that the Spaniards had held when they took the lands belonged to the Mayans, he couldn't believe it. He thought that he was looking for something red and he found something white. And they grow on these nopal cactuses. So they're the ones that look like, you know, the cartoons with kind of like roadrunners and things like that. They look like stop signs, these nopal cactuses. So they grow on those. They're parasitic and they, you know, if you leave them for too long, they kill the cactus because they're eating and eating and eating. That was one of the stories in color. I mean, one of the 150 stories in color, but it was one of my favorites. What had happened was a designer at the Getty Museum. So he's one of the sort of the designers who creates the books, the look of the books that they create for their wonderful exhibitions. He read my book and then he, living in California, he went out with his teenage or pre-teenage son and he noticed a cactus that kind of looked like a stop sign, and it had a sort of white, what looked like, I suppose, a white illness on it, white kind of like globules. Then he thought, I wonder if that's cochineal. So he scraped it off and looked at my book, but also obviously was able to Google to see what you do. And he was astonished to find that what he had got was the ancient Spanish, Mayan, Aztec, Inca enzyme that became very easily a dye and sometimes a fugitive paint. Right. And he was just like, so I got so excited. I just banged my desk just then, just in case anybody wondered what because I get really excited when I talk about this stuff. So he found that and he obviously, well, he thought that was really brilliant. And he thought, why don't we publish a book about that? And they have a huge range of books that they publish about art, but one of the sort of the important areas that they really do like to concentrate on is books that are not patronizing and they're fun for adults.
Yeah.
But they also, yeah, you'd also be really happy to give to your teenage or pre-teenage, and you might find that they become interested in the subject. So it's accessible, it's fun. And so they commissioned me to write this book. And I suppose the only real compromise that I made there was that if there was a story about a teenager or a young person, then that's what I led on, right? And actually, there were a lot of teenagers and young people in the history of colour. Who would know? But so, for example, in 1856, a young older teenager was doing experiments. He was very clever. In fact, he was one of the gifted young people, and he was really good at chemistry. So he'd been brought in early to one of the sort of the chemistry degrees, and his homework was to try and synthesize some of the gunk that came from coal tar, it was called. Synthesize that or try and see whether they could or couldn't make something that was like quinine, i.e. could help protect people from malaria, which in so many parts of the world killed people. And so that's what he was doing. He was only 17, 18, and he did his experiment. It didn't work. He had this stuff in his test tube, and he was just pouring it out at the end of the day it was in his parents' home, and it was in the sink, in the basin, the white enamel. It was like this really cool color. It was so it was a deep purple, right? The kind of purple Prince Purple Rain kind of color, right? At the time, yes. In the sink. So as he washed it away, he thought, that's interesting. That is interesting. So he didn't wash it all away. He worked out what it was, and he invented synthetic colours. So that was a teenage story that was brilliant.
And that's what I love about this book. And of course, for everybody listening, I'll be putting all the links to all the references we'll be talking about in your books as well. And what I find it's nail-biting, because it's a story of adventure and mystery, and the images are just so beautiful. It's such a treat. This book is just, to quote Cheryl Strayed, if you want to put yourself in the way of beauty, get yourself this book.
I was so moved when I got that quote.
Actually, the first question I usually ask all my guests is the root question. The root question is, when you were about 10, and you started to actually answer that earlier on, what were you fascinated about? What were you passionate about? Yeah.
So when I was 8, I went, we live in the UK, and we used to go to France. We loved France for our holidays, and we would drive down and drive back. And once we stopped in Chartres, and I was 8 years old, and it had been raining. And you know how when it's been raining and then suddenly the sun comes out, it's a particular quality of sun and a particular quality of light. And it's kind of, it's almost tangible. It's almost holy, I suppose. But anyway, we went into that cathedral, and it looked like the blue and red lights were dancing on the inside. And it because I suppose it was all just shimmering and scintillating. And it was unforgettable. And my father said, look, he held me by the hand. I still remember. And he said, look at that blue glass. they made it 800 years ago, and we don't know how to make it anymore. Not like that. And I thought, I want to learn how to make, I want to find, and this is my quest, right? I want to find out what it is in that amazing glass that we can't do anymore, and I want to get us to do it. What did I want to do when I was a child? I wanted to be a writer, that was definite, and around that same eight-year-old time, I wanted to write The Jungle Book, but with a girl as Mowgli. I wanted to be an explorer, an adventurer. I wanted to be a sailor, and I definitely wanted to be a pilot.
How interesting. So basically, you really have answered that little Victoria's dream by developing your career.
Yeah. So when I was 18, so this is not a child anymore, but I really wanted to go to India, and I went in my year abroad. I got a job. I worked in a magistrate's court, which is the first job in the job centre that was available, and I spent the money on a motorbike, which obviously was deliberately to displease my parents, and as well as obviously to get myself around, and an 8-week trip to India, and I fell in love with it. And the next year I went back, and I lived in a Tibetan refugee camp, and I fell in love really well with the people that I was with, but also with the notion that there's a huge cultural diversity, and that you can't imagine yourself into the position of understanding what other people are thinking. And I guess I hadn't thought, oh yes you can, but I hadn't thought about it, and suddenly the world seemed much more extraordinary when I did.
I totally relate to that. Coming back to the book, I love how it's been divided. So it's in three parts. The first one is Earth and Fire. Then you have Rocks, Minerals, Twigs, and Bugs. And we were talking about that earlier on with the color red. And then it concludes with Modern Colors. Every two page or something, like, it's so compelling. It's dynamic. You have so many information on the colors, on the history, on how it was applied in art and where it comes from. And it actually reinforces my belief that history at school should be taught alongside art history. And I think that people would better comprehend the world we live in and where we're from.
Totally agree with you. And when I've been making each of these books, I've tried to make myself, just for my own use, a timeline of what was happening here in the world when something was happening else. Some of them obviously were ones that I knew about. I have kind of written about history and studied history and things like that. But honestly, some little connections, things that were happening at the same time, this isn't a world-changing moment at all, but in England in the early 17th century, the king who was King James I of England, King James the 6th of Scotland, he was ordering all the aristocratic families to stock up on mulberries in order to manage to the silk industry. They were ordered from France, who very sweetly sent black mulberries, which are very attractive trees, but the silkworms don't like, in order to safeguard the French sericulture industry. So that was a good bit of trickery across the channel. But say at the very same time in Assam, the king there was making a statement that every woman, it sounds like a fairy story, but it isn't, every woman had to spin a certain amount of thread each day before sunset on pain of punishment.
Okay.
So that meant...
Oh my gosh, okay.
So it's an oh gosh, isn't it? So that meant that Assam's textile industry, as it was in the 17th century, was assured and strong. And it meant that women were forced to work for that kind of state brutality, really, that was all about ordering them around. But it also means that today Assam has one of the strongest home weaving traditions that there is in India still. So it was an extraordinary thing to do, and it was happening at the same time. So you watch how different leaders forced people to do things for an industry. It doesn't really matter. It was all the fabric industry, because that was my subject. But really to watch how people, men, impose power on largely women to make the GDP, yeah, word that didn't exist then, but a concept that did, stronger. So I liked the timeline idea, because that wouldn't have happened if I hadn't got a timeline. And I really think I would have loved history more.
I personally think that I would have remembered it better if it had been brought up with stories that was so applicable on the day that you were learning it. So for instance, you talk about how back 2,500 years ago, there were plenty of paint colors. We don't think of that.
When William Perkin, the teenager who I talked about earlier, who invented synthetic colors through purple, the first name he gave it, he was, remember, an 18-year-old boy, a scientist, not a branding expert. So he called it Tyrian purple, because he had just graduated with classics, and in the town of Tyre in what is now Lebanon, they had specialized in this extraordinary purple. In fact, there was a group of people who were operating about 2,500 years ago called the Phoenicians, which means the purple people, and it meant that they were the purple, yes, traders, and they were hugely brilliant traders, and they made loads of money from it. So at that time, they were making purple from a kind of enzyme, but from shellfish. And it wasn't clear exactly how the shellfish dyes were made, because they were top secret for a very, very long time, until they were forgotten, not because of synthetic colors. They were forgotten somewhere in the medieval period when other colors came in, or maybe after other colors came in, mixing woad with red to make a kind of much cheaper purple. And also when, because a lot of these stories, whether they are about, frankly, whether they're about stones, about colors, about fabrics, a lot of them are about what we would now call sustainability. And those are some of the issues. You get greedy. Everybody wants purple. It's not just the Caesars. It's every woman who would like to be kind of seen as being kitted out and glamorous, wants to have a purple toga. As soon as that happens, then the areas of the Mediterranean get fished out. So these are kind of issues that are always happening. So, yeah, so Tyrian purple was happening then 2,500 years ago. Really huge and kind of lovely, one of these arcane, bizarre and completely obscure debates. But, you know, what colour was Tyrian purple? Because you kind of think it's that sort of deep prince purple. But there's a chance that it was actually quite a bright pink, quite a sort of hot pink. That could have been the purple. We don't know for sure, because we know that that seashell, that sea creature, can mix, when you mix it with what's called a mordant, which is a sort of metal salt, which makes it fix to the fabric. If you put different kind of metal salts on it, it can be a really pale, blushy pink, or a really deep, almost, it was called an ox blood. It was that dark kind of.
Yeah.
Which one of those colors, shade colors, meant money? Because that's what we're talking about for purple. Uh-huh. Whereas, and obviously there's gold, whereas for other colors like ochre mm-hmm. can be a kind of mustard color, or it can be a red yeah. color. And that depends on whether it's been burnt or not, whether it's been heated or not. But certainly we know in Australia, within written living memory, some ochres were beyond expensive. You had to do a pilgrimage across Australia for that. Aboriginal tribes would cross Australia once a year to go to the mines in which this sacred ochre was found. They would petition the ancestors, the spirits of the mine and their own ancestors, and they would return, trade it on the way, and the Australian continent was traversed in large part peaceably for this reason, because of ochre, because of the need that people had for it. But that shows that certain pigments that gleamed, that's what we know, it's the gleamy ones. They weren't just normal materials for trading. They were something really sacred. So that was also because ochre has been sacred in North America as well. So we can't assume, but there is a possibility that there has been a sense that these colours were sacred.
And even with the pharaohs and in Egypt, there were the greens that were used and the blue, there's a pharaoh blue that was specific. And a lot of these colors, yeah, held some properties that were either, I don't know if magic is the word, but definitely sacred. So we go back a long, long time. We go back to the beginning of your book where you talk about the caves, you know, of the Stone Age that were discovered, and people, actually, you know, modern graffiti artists have not invented anything. When you see all the handprints in South America, and that looks like it's been spray painted, but we go back thousands of years, and so color is paramount to our experience of life.
I think it is. I think it is, and I suppose our experience of life, obviously, you know, one can reduce it to the kind of thing, you know, that we need to be. We want to be warm. We want to be in community with each other. We want to eat.
Yes.
And we seem as human beings to want to establish what layers of authority there are in any community. Even a non-hierarchical still has layers of authority. So power is seemingly important in communities. But also, I really think that whatever you call it, and it can be called lots of different ways, and so I'm going to use very loosely the sense of beauty. Beauty or creativity could be to do with power, but also might not be. And yet it actually expresses something that we all notice that in different ways, however we work. So I'm a writer, so I notice it when I'm writing. You're an artist, so I'm sure you notice this thing happening when you create something that you know. It's not even about it being good, is it? It just has it. It either has it or it doesn't. And sometimes you create something that has it, and then you can get excited. And I think
it's transcending.
Just transcend. And I think that people who invent, that word invent, which is obviously itself suggesting that something is breathed in, I think that there is something that happens there. And I think that it can happen on any day when you make a link with something. Sometimes when you make a link with somebody in terms of connection. But I think when you make mental links and physical links with things, these things are always there and they're exciting. I think for me that this creating that I seem to have got very fascinated in throughout my life, I think it's all connected with all of that. I think that it's something that seems to be superficial, or that some people might argue was superficial, and yet actually I think that it's reflecting something quite deep.
A celebration of life. It feels like, yes, color could be associated with power, because like we said, if it was a difficult sourcing of a color and then it was very expensive, of course not everybody was wearing red, purple at some time in the history.
Celebration of life, too, but expensive. Also a recognition of death. I mean, these two things at the same time. So when you see the light, there's no point in just it all being light, is there? I mean, it can't all be light in any of our lives. If it was all light, it wouldn't have any texture to it. I mean, quality.
It needs to live in opposition. Yes. So the colors and the as much as the, yes, the colors and then the experience of life. So there seemed to be a parallel between all this. I know you've got, over all these researches, all the years, all your travels, so many fascinating stories. I mean, we could spend hours just talking about this one book. But I was curious as to which of the stories have stricken you as most fascinating, most precious. Is there one that kind of always comes back to you as a treasure more than another?
Yes, actually, I've had this really interesting summer. So this summer, I have been given the chance to read back three of my books, not The Brilliant History of Colour and Art, but the other three, so Colour, Jewels and Fabric, or for audio. And so it's been quite interesting revisiting some of the stories, many of which I remembered, but a few of which I had forgotten, and so I've kind of re-treasured them. So I suppose the ones that I just couldn't bear not to have done, there's quite a few of them, but one of them was the extraordinary experience, really, of going to Afghanistan to try and find the blue that Michelangelo used in his paintings, which we call ultramarine. Wow. And it's lapis lazuli. And so that blue stone that is complicated blue stone, actually, it's not a simple color. And it's a blue mountain, or it's a mountain with blue inside it that has been definitely mined and the blue transported for 6,000 years. So we know that 6,000 years ago, blue that had to come from that mountain in Afghanistan went to Egypt because we found the stones. It wasn't made into paint at that point, because making it into paint from blue stone is actually super complicated. I can go into it, but it basically pounded
it
down.
Yeah, go into it. What does it mean?
Because
it's a rock.
Powder with gum. Okay. You keep on kneading it like bread, and then you let it float to the top. Then you take that powder, and then you do so. It's complicated.
Oh my gosh.
How to make it into paint. So it wasn't made into paint until about the 5th, 6th century. And the first known use of that blue as paint was above the Buddhas of Bamiyan, which were extraordinary, huge, I forget how many meters, so inventing something like 50-meter high Buddhas set into the cliffs. And in the 5th, 6th century, by when it was a Buddhist area, and they were standing Buddhas, and behind them were staircases, and you could stand on the head of the Buddha and look above at the ceiling in the cliff face, and you could see paintings, frescoes of Buddhist stories of the birth of Buddha and his teachings. And the blue in that was the first known use of the blue. I was very lucky in 2000, I went to Afghanistan for the first time. I was trying to find the mountains. There was war. I was on the wrong side of the firing line.
Yeah.
But I was able to go to Bamiyan as a sort of pilgrimage to see that very first use of blue. And so I was able to see the Buddhas of Bamiyan. They were already, the Taliban were already gunning for them effectively. They had what looked like almost coal under their eyes, but it was the sign of burnt tires that had been dropped. So a few months later, they were destroyed in a deliberate explosion.
Oh my gosh. Okay.
And then the following year, I went to the blue mines in an area which then was the 10% of Afghanistan that was holding out against the Taliban. And I had this extraordinary journey through these ancient lands to find the blue stone. And I talked to miners in Afghanistan, the lives of women and men are very, very different. Men have much greater freedoms. Women have their own domain in houses, and at the blue mines there were no houses that were able to have those two worlds. So it was basically men on their own. Their wives were in their villages elsewhere, so they told me the story of what was happening in their villages. And there were stories of people who, one man, his family had just had mulberries to eat, and mulberry leaves like silk worms. That's what they had. That's what he knew they had. And they weren't finding any stones either. So they weren't able, but they were hoping. And it was, I found it very moving to talk to those people, talk to those men who were really trying to make the money to keep their children alive. I wouldn't have missed that. But more recently, for my fabric book, I was very lucky. Another question I had asked is bark cloth. How do you make cloth out of bark? I'd seen it in museums. I'd never touched it. But how do you make it?
Bark, like the
tree? Yeah, it's called bark cloth. And what I found was it's not actually the outer bit of a tree trunk, very thin tree trunk, by the way. Just, you know, if you closed your thumb and your second finger together, that's about the width of those trees when they're cut. Wasn't it scratchy? What did it feel like? I had all of those questions, and I found out that bark cloth is traditionally in Africa, but traditionally it's mostly really still critically important in parts of the Pacific. And so I wanted to go and see it being made in a traditional way, not a, you know, let's show you the historical way it was made, but actually, and I was really lucky. I was invited to visit a tribe called the Maisin in Papua New Guinea, and they still make bark cloth for their rituals, but they still have a lot of rituals. They love their rituals, you know, rituals at all times, feast days, and funerals and welcomes to the village, to people. So they do wear that bark cloth a lot. And they also trade it a lot. And the trading has always been a way of keeping peace within or along coastlines where people are going to be fighting over fishing rights and things like that. But this particular bark cloth, which is beautiful, and we stayed there for 2 weeks, and I learned how to make it. I learned how to paint it. I watched people painting it. I learned about life, I think, in that time. So the village is extremely beautiful. It's coconut trees, and behind it is beautiful lands, and it's an absolutely immaculately clean village that the women each morning before they start making the bark cloth, which sounds like sort of bang, 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 you hear sweep, 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 and yet it's an empowering. It feels empowering. This is important. Behind that are the gardens, about 7 kilometers behind. So slightly raised. We're slightly going uphill by now, but into kind of forest jungle, but it's used for gardens. It's a kind of shifting cultivation, so you'd stay in a garden for 2 to 4 years and be moving on to the next one while the existing ones regrow for 20 years or something like that.
So sustainability again.
Sustainability. And behind that is virgin forest with birds of paradise and these butterflies that are really like huge, as big as a paperback, that or bigger than paperback, probably. They're the biggest butterflies in the world. So this astonishing, valuable to the world forest. And obviously you can guess what's happening. It's valuable to toilet paper as well. And it's valuable to big conglomerates who don't care about the biggest butterflies in the world or indigenous culture, or actually what we need to preserve in this world if we are going to move on, because these are beautiful things, right? These are just beautiful. Forget about the use of them. So this forest is being threatened. And further along, we saw kind of these great, beautiful, huge logs that are bigger than any tree that I've seen. I think that in Canada, actually, I have seen some areas that were threatened with virgin great trees. And that's the one thing it reminded me of, I'm afraid, was your virgin rainforest that was being removed for toilet paper at the same time. This tribe, it needs very little, actually, from the outside world. But obviously, there is increased pressure and people want things like phones. But what they need a teacher and books and a school to run, and they also need medicine. They have a traditional medicine, but if your wife is pregnant and there's problems with the birth, you want to be able to get her to somebody who will actually save her life. And so they need, in order to make that happen, they need they have a boat, but they need the petrol, the fuel that will bring the diesel that will bring it quite far up, quite far away to the hospital. So those are the things that they absolutely needed. And that those are the things that, in a way, for which they might sell their tribally owned lands. And it was bark cloth. It was a program that was run not just with Greenpeace, but with other NGOs, but also with the Maisin people very much at the helm as well of this. But it was to actually say, right, we've got this wonderful cloth. It's beautiful, it's different, it's traditional, and yet we can make it work in a new way as well. So they have hand-operated or foot-operated, but anyway, non-electric sewing machines brought in, and each family can have one. And they'll make these spark cloth into hats, into bags, into mobile phone cases, and they can sell that in Port Moresby. And they have so far, please God, they have actually managed not to sell and to hold out against some very tricky,
oh, wow,
and very nasty and very vicious strategies that are not honest, yeah, and that involve corruption and pretense. But so far, bark cloth has saved that forest. And do you know something? I promised them that I would tell that story as often as I could, and so I have. And really, it's truthful and it's valuable. And it made me think that I was so glad, so honoured, so pleased that I was able to visit them and hear their stories.
Well, to honour that, of course, now we'll be able to bring this podcast to the world and talk about this story. And I'll be putting, again, links in the show notes so people can learn a bit more about these stories. What I keep from our conversation is how color, finding colors, a creation of colors, there's so many ways it's been done through the history of mankind, how paramount to our life. That's what color has been so important for us and on so many levels, but also how sustainability comes in the conversation very quickly, way back in the days, 100 years ago. That's very interesting. And I've been wondering, how do you see the future around these topics and the place they have in our life? What would you like to see happen? And what do you think might happen?
Really good question. I think that 22 years ago, I might have answered on the colour front that I'd like to see a lot more natural colours. All right. And I do love to, and I have, and I am seeing more natural colours. And when those colours are sustainable, that's wonderful. I have also seen examples where natural colours are not sustainable, and that brings with it its own problems. So I do think it's a complex answer, because there are billions of us now on this planet, and we all want beauty and we all want nice, don't we?
Quickly and bountiful.
So, but what I would like to see, in fact, this is how I ended the fabric book. I heard about something which is called the Higg Index, and it was named after the Higg boson, but basically it happened when Walmart and Patagonia, so two very different strategy, different sized, different everything companies, decided to get together and work, yeah, out how they could potentially work together to make things more sustainable, because sustainability is important, but also it's not just that it's expensive, it's complicated to work it out. And so when they had that meeting, and they realized that one of the big kind of issues, quite apart from whether they wanted things to be sustainable or not, was how to work out whether they were being or not, and what questions to ask, because you could ask questions of one, I don't know, waterproof fabric maker, and they might be able to answer half of them, but not the others. The problem was that there wasn't any consistency in the questions that were being asked and the questions that people were preparing to answer, as even in good faith. So they created a questionnaire. They worked with other big organizations as well, who wanted to join in this and wanted to help make it happen. At the moment, that questionnaire, it's not legally binding, but the questionnaire, they've worked on it together. So therefore, suppliers, if they're supplying Patagonia or Walmart or Marks and Spencer or many other companies, they would expect to be asked exactly those questions. So they would already be answering those questions. And those have been identified as some of the ones that need to be answered. The questions have changed over time. So now it also involves the treatment of the people who do the sewing, the treatment of the people who,
yes,
make the machines that do the sewing. There are more and more questions. And at the moment, it's just for internal use. And yet, I think that by asking those questions, things are already beginning to change. I would really love to think that whether it's the Higg or whether it's something else, that we have a chance when we buy clothes, when we buy fabric or materials like that, that we can probably through our phones hold the QR code and find out who made it, where it was made, under what criteria it was made, and how much it cost the planet. And what, this is another thing, that is kind of increasing really for everything, it should increase, is what happens at the end? You know, what happens at the end when we finish wearing what we're wearing, or when we finish using what we use? And obviously, at least these things have been used. How about what happens at the end when it didn't sell in Black Friday and it's got to be dumped? What happens at the end? Is there a way of thinking in advance that quite a lot of this stuff will be wasted? So let's not waste it. Let's have a place that when it didn't work as A, it is transformed into B and has another chance to be useful, and then to C. And that's what I dream of, really, that it's not the end.
Oh, that's fabulous. Thank you so much for this conversation. It's just been so rich and so enlightening. I think the meaning of all this, whether it was color, whether it was textile and sustainability around, that's weaved around all these topics. Victoria, so your audiobooks are coming out in November.
So they are out now in the UK. In the US, the audiobooks for the first two, so Color and Jewels, are coming out, I believe, in January.
It's probably the best gift you can offer this Christmas time or for the holidays, or whether you know someone who loves history, art. I think there's just wonderful books.
That's really nice. Thank you very much.
What is your next book? Do you know?
I've just come back from I had a wonderful month-long cycling in France and Spain. And I went with a friend for the first 3 weeks. And I had this idea that, especially in the last week when I'd be cycling on my own, I would really kind of crystallize this. I had like three ideas. And obviously I've come back and I'm like, oh, okay, I had actually better now think about it. I have got something that's really exciting. So I'll be talking to my agent about it in the next couple of weeks.
That's great. So I'm looking forward to discover that. Thank you so much, Victoria, for your time and for your work. I think it's just essential. So I hope everybody's gonna go and have a look and discover these books.
Oh, thank you so much for inviting me. That was great. And thank you for listening.
Thank you. Thank you for being with us today. I hope you've been able to identify how you can integrate innovation and creativity in your daily life. If you would like to dive in or know more, you can contact me on my website, enoughcrea.com. Special thanks to Millimetric, who composed my music themes. Thank you for listening, and bye for now.